Good morning. We're delighted to welcome Union Grove High School students. Would they please stand? Good having you with us. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. High schools across the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if the students agree to come, then they are given material about the case and may engage in some activities relating to the case. After the oral argument, the second oral argument on oral argument day, the students are meeting with one of the justices of this court, and they discuss the procedures of the court in taking and deciding a case, not the substantive issues of the case. So, is there anyone in the courtroom who would like a summary of this case, a synopsis of this case? Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is the justice with whom you will meet after our second case. Seated next to her is Justice Jason Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case today, 07-AP-1799, Douglas Osborne versus Harold Dennison. Arguing on behalf of Douglas Osborne is Attorney John A. Becker. Mr. Becker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I'm John Becker, representing Doug Osborne. And in this case, just to summarize the arguments first, this is a contract case, a real estate case, and it is our position that first, the contract does not call for directing the return of the earnest money before starting suit. It doesn't say that in the contract. Secondly, if the contract is construed that way for some reason, then what the complaint asks for is compensatory damages. Under the Gale Towage case, you can ask for compensatory damages and then change your claim to actual damages. And third, if somehow the contract is construed that you have to return the earnest money, you can't start the suit and claim compensatory damages, then it is a condition precedent and the proper remedy would be dismissal without prejudice, and then when the condition is met, the case can proceed. So that's a summary of the arguments.
Mr. Becker, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
One of the things that concerned me was looking at the transcript of what occurred in front of Judge Kluka. Initially, it sounded as if the dismissal was without prejudice. And then apparently you had some kind of conference off the record, and she came back on and started talking about her dismissal being with prejudice. I'm just wondering, is it clear that ultimately the order that was entered was a dismissal with prejudice?
Actually, what happened was we were there, and the first motion of the defendant was to actually limit the damages to $2,000. It wasn't for dismissal of anything. We said, no, we have the right to claim actual damages. The court held that the claim would be limited to $2,000. And then we brought a motion for clarification saying, well, if that's the case, there really isn't much to try here. And we asked for clarification and said, otherwise, we'll dismiss it without prejudice. And the court said, that's fine. And the other attorney did not object. And then we went out and he says, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm not sure. I said, I may appeal that or I may, you know, dismiss it, maybe refile. I hadn't decided yet. So then he wanted to go back and straighten this out. And he asked the judge, he says, well, judge, this is, you know, they don't have the right to refile. I said, Judge, that's not before the court. I said, if I refile later and the court says I can, I mean, that's an issue that can be decided later. And then the judge went into saying, She didn't dismiss it. She said, this is a finding, and she basically she ordered judgment for $2,000. It wasn't even a dismissal. It was an order that the plaintiff got judgment for $2,000. So that is ultimately what the trial court judge did. So, in reviewing the facts, I mean, the dates aren't that important. What's really important is the sequence. There was an offer and acceptance. There's no dispute about that. The closing did not take place. There's no dispute about that. That was in May of 2005. The plaintiff got a letter from the defendant's attorney saying, we want the earnest money back. We are going to defend vigorously any claims that you bring, and we reserve the right to sue you for any damages we sustain. At that point, the plaintiff said to the broker, just hold the money, and I think he may have indicated he was going to sue for actual damages, but at that time, he obviously would not even know because he had not sold the property. You know, he would have had the right to retain the earnest money and sue for a specific performance, but he didn't know at that time, but he just told the broker to hold the earnest money. That was all happened in May of 2005. Months later, he did sell the house. Then a lawsuit was started, asked for compensatory damages.
Excuse me, I'm just a little confused. Is this still in response to Justice Crooks' question, or is this something else that you're talking about?
Oh, no, I thought I had answered that. Then I was kind of reviewing the facts.
Okay, that's what I thought. And what was the answer to Justice Crooks' question? Was this a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice, and is that clear?
First, she dismissed it without prejudice, and then she went back, and it wasn't, I don't know if you call it a dismissal, it was a judgment. She didn't dismiss the case with prejudice. She entered a judgment. A judgment was entered for the plaintiff.
I want to stop you there then. I have two things. First of all, she had an order for judgment, she being the circuit court judge, and that clearly said that it was dismissed with prejudice, didn't it? It's dated the 11th day of June, 2007.
Yeah, I guess just like a jury trial or whatever, I mean, once the judgment is entered, the case is dismissed without prejudice, or with prejudice, and it can't come back. So I guess, yeah, she was saying, this is my finding, I'm going to order judgment, now the case will be dismissed.
With prejudice.
With prejudice,
that's
at that
right.
Point. Yeah.
So, I mean, I wasn't clear from your response whether the answer was yes. The record reflects that it was dismissed with prejudice.
Ultimately, that's what she did. She ordered judgment, and then with the judgment, dismissed it with prejudice.
And that's because there's an order for judgment that indicates that, and also that's because it's in the transcript on page 24 and 25 of the record, where the court says, that is, they may retain their earnest money, and therefore I will order that the dismissal be with prejudice.
Right.
Okay, so is there any question that she entered it? A dismissal on this record with prejudice?
No. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Dennison then owes your client $2,000?
The judgment was entered. Actually, he needed the judgment off his record, so the money was put in trust and the judgment was satisfied.
So he doesn't know. Does he have to pay anything more?
At this point, the money is being held in trust.
Now, what do you want to do with what the circuit court did? Do you want to say that he doesn't owe you the $2,000?
Correct. But we want to say that we want the right to be able to pursue his actual damages in this case.
Which is what he got less for the property than
correct.
This offer, I assume.
Correct.
That's the damages.
Correct.
And if you do that, does he have a right to sue you, too?
I'm sorry,
does he have a right to sue you as well?
I don't see why not. He could raise any counterclaims. I mean
you want to basically start from scratch?
So the very, well, we wanted the option to sue for actual damages. And the judge said we couldn't. Just like any other case, it gets reversed. We want to go back and try the case.
Okay, you want to keep the $2,000?
I'm sorry?
You want to keep the $2,000 while you're trying the case?
No.
You're going to give the $2,000 back?
You give it back.
Okay.
How long have you had the $2,000?
It was after the judgment was entered.
But I mean,
before the judge made this decision, I think it was April 06, long before that, the money was directed, the broker directed the broker to give the money back. Okay, prior to that time, Mr. Dennison had demanded the money. Mr. Osborne did not want it released. Neither party had the right to the money. The broker, if you look at the contract, the broker holds the money. And they have several options. They can release it upon the agreement of both parties. There was not an agreement. So neither party was going to be able to get that money. Neither party had the right to that money. Second thing a broker can do is start a suit and pay it into the court to resolve it that way. Basically, the broker wants to get out of it. That's where the money was. After the suit was started, a few weeks after that, I believe it was, that then the letter was sent to the broker specifically saying, send the money back. The broker continued to hold it until after the judgment, in which they said, can you put it in your trust account? And it was put into the trust account.
Whose trust account? Yours?
I believe it's mine, yes.
Okay.
So would it be fair to say that Mr. Dennison has not had that $2,000 since March 1st, 2005?
Correct.
So you want him not to have that money.
Okay.
Also, to be able to sue him. Is that right?
No, that is not correct. We directed the return of the money. He would not accept it at that point. The lawsuit was pending. We directed the broker to give the money back. I think it's about 2 years ago now, we're willing to give it back. At that point, he then said he didn't want it.
No one had the use of this money.
Correct.
Mr. Dennison didn't have the use of the money because it was in the broker's account.
Correct.
Your client doesn't have the use of the money because it was either in the broker's account or in your account. This
Correct.
Money is just being held pending final disposition of this case.
Correct.
Right. So who keeps the interest on all this? IOLTA?
Yes.
Okay. They're not a party.
Right.
All right.
So, it just seems to me you want to have your cake and eat it too.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, the case in here, the Zimmerman case, was a case where they said the seller cannot retain the earnest money and as liquidated damages, and commence an action for actual damages. In Galatowicz, neither party had the right to that earnest money. Galatowicz, what we sued here, we sued for compensatory damages. Compensatory damages can be liquidated damages or actual damages. Liquidated damages, all that means is that the amount has been specified. Again, you can have a judge, I think I put in my brief that you can go to a trial, you can have pain and suffering, lost wages, whatever. After the judgment, the amount becomes liquidated. It's still compensatory damages. The claim asks for compensatory damages. In Galatowicz, they asked for their earnest money, which is compensatory damages. In Galatowicz, after the house was sold, they amended their complaint and then requested actual damages. And the court said, you can do that. Neither party had the right to that earnest money during the pendency of that lawsuit. Just like in this case, neither party has the right to the money. In the Zimmerman case, the plaintiff had the money. He had the money in hand. He retained it. He had the right to use that money for whatever he wanted to. He could have used it to finance his lawsuit if he wanted to. In this case, Osborne did not have that option.
Was there a written disbursement agreement?
I'm sorry?
Was there a written disbursement agreement?
After the judgment, there may have been...
Well, pursuant to the contract under where it talks about disbursement, and it talks about if the offer does not close, the earnest money shall be dispersed according to the written disbursement agreement signed by the parties to the offer, and it cites to the administrative code.
No, there was no written agreement. That would presuppose that the parties are in agreement that either the buyer can keep it or the seller can keep it. In this case, Mr. Dennison was not conceding that Mr. Osborne could keep the earnest money. He was saying, I didn't breach the contract, I want that money back. Mr. Osborne, you can't have it.
Exactly what language do you hang your hat on for your argument? The language of the offer. Exactly what is your...
What's the language of the contract itself. The language in the contract says that the buyer or the seller has several options. One is they could retain the earnest money and sue for specific performance, which you can't at the time Mr. Dennison demanded the money back. That was one option. We could have retained the earnest money and still sued for specific performance. Two, he can terminate the offer, and then he has the option to request the earnest money as liquidated damages, which clearly Osborne never did. There's no request in writing. There's no verbal request. There's no record of any request in writing. Or three, he can direct the broker to return the earnest money and have the option to sue for actual damages. And again, I've set forth in my brief numerous authorities on English grammar, including the Supreme Court in the Green Bay Broadcasting case, which says the term and does not connote any sequence or order. So it doesn't say you have to, they're trying to write into the contract, you have to first return, direct the return of the earnest money, and then you have the option to sue for actual damage. It does not say that. I'm relying on the contract.
Counselor, with the statute of limitations on breach of contract being 6 years, would it have been possible for the buyer here to request the money back, your client to refuse and say no, and then you to wait 5 years before you brought suit and gave back the money? Is there any time limit on, I mean, you waited almost a year between the request for the return of earnest money and its refusal before you sued. Could you have waited 5 years?
That's the statute of limitations. I mean, there's nothing to stop the buyer from also bringing an action saying, you know, for the return of the earnest money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, neither party has to wait.
No, but sometimes it's not worth suing somebody for $2,000 for you. Make your attorney your favorite charity when you
Correct.
Do that.
So. And again, this... When looking through the record, you can see the transaction was handled by somebody else and later referred to our office. So there was some gaps in there. But it's a six-year statute. I mean...
Okay. So you don't see the waiting of the time after the request for the return of the earnest money and the refusal as really having any bearing on the legal issue we have to decide?
I don't... No, no. I mean, if... you know, certainly he waited to see if he could sell the house, which was, I believe, in October. Again, there was some delay in getting the file transferred after the lawsuit was started. Then, again, it was brought to our attention, and we directed the broker to give the money back.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't think that there's a problem. You know, that's what the statute is. I mean, it's 6 years.
Okay,
I don't think most people are going to wait that long, but that's what the law is.
But you don't think it bears on the legal issues where...
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker, what's wrong with the approach taken by the Court of Appeals? They basically said, as I understand it, there's a condition precedent here. And that condition precedent is that before you sue, you have to direct the return of the money. And if you don't satisfy that condition precedent, then you're limited to the liquidated damages, the $2,000 earnest money or down payment. What's wrong with that reasoning?
Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, I mean, their logic is kind of, they're saying by, first of all, they're interpreting the complaint, the request for compensatory damages, to be a complaint for actual damages. I mean, first of all, they've done that. But assuming, taking that for right now, they're then saying that by electing option B, you have elected option A. I mean, that's just a little inconsistent, first of all. Secondly, they are rewriting that clause. They are saying, they are inserting the word first in there. You first have to direct the broker to return the earnest money. It doesn't say that. Again, the Galatowicz case, what happened there was they sued for the earnest money, which, again, is a form of compensatory damages. The court said that at some point, there may be a stage beyond which, in the proceedings beyond which, you have to make that choice. And this is not an election of remedies issue. I think Justice Rosenczak wrote an opinion about a year or two ago on a case on election of remedies. And election of remedies is when you have competing...
Inconsistent.
Yes. If you're suing for rescission and for damages, that would be an election of remedies issue. These are not two different remedies. The remedy is damages. It's a question of what damages are you going to prove, just like any other case when you go to court. Let's say it's a personal injury case. You go to court, file a complaint, you get a scheduling order. In that scheduling order, they'll say, you have 3 months or whatever it is to name your experts, provide your special damages. So the other side has some idea what the complaint is or what damages you're going to try to prove. Well, the same thing here. You have a complaint here for compensatory damages. At some point, yes, the scheduling order of the court would say, all right, now what damages are you going to claim? And you have a certain date in which to provide such proof that you're going to rely on to the other side so that they can then defend that claim. Again, I gave several examples in the brief of situations where you may not know when you file a complaint. Maybe there's a smaller amount in dispute. Or maybe, you know, I think I used the example where, you know, somebody sells a house and the furnace is 30 years old. They sell it for $75,000. Well, maybe the $75,000 price took into account that within the next year you're going to have to pay $5,000 for a new furnace. Well, whatever, the furnace goes out, or the deal falls through, and the house sells for $8,000 less. Well, the defendant, you know, seller may sue for $8,000. Not even knowing if the buyer is going to raise that as a defense. Well, then the buyer raises it as a defense, and the plaintiff says, well, it's just not worth the hassle. I might lose on that issue. I may have to hire experts. I'll just take the earnest money. So, yes, there comes a time in the proceedings, which would appropriately be established by the scheduling order, where the court would say, okay, all right, as of this date, you've got to tell them what damages you're going to claim or what you're going to try to prove. At that point, the plaintiff may say, I'm not even going to try to prove damages. I'm just going to try to prove the breach and the earnest money. Or they may say, I'm going to try to prove, you know, here are the damages I'm going to prove. Here's the experts that I'm going to call. I'm going to claim $8,000 worth of damages or whatever it is. But again, sometimes you don't even know when you file a complaint which you're going to try to prove up. But again, it's not an election of remedies. It's how you're going to prove your damages. And again, that's something that's always been established by the scheduling order.
Let's see. This case was filed April 28, 2006.
Correct.
And there was an answer on June 1st, 2006.
Correct.
And your client advised the broker to return the earnest money on June 23rd, 2006.
Correct.
How long, in your view, could the seller have waited before returning the earnest money?
At the point in time that, again, established by the scheduling order, you go to the scheduling order and the court says, okay, you have three months to name your experts, you know, and provide your special damages, whatever it is. Well, at that point, if we're going to claim that the damages are $10,000, $20,000, whatever it is, you know, we're going to have to provide that to the other side so they can prepare a defense. So, again, that'd be, and if we're not going to do that, we say, okay, you know, and at that point we say, okay, here's the money back, we're going to try to prove damages. Or at that point we may say, it's not worth the bother, you know, we found out through some discovery that they have a valid defense or they have some defenses to at least diminish the damages, it's just not worth the hassle anymore, we'll just take the earnest money. The purpose of the earnest money is to protect the seller. And if you have to give it back before you can even make a decision, it defeats the purpose. I believe my warning light is on.
You've got five more minutes.
Pardon?
Yeah, five more minutes.
Okay. So, again,
if I may, I get a sense that the opposing party is not a pauper.
I'm sorry?
It's not a pauper.
I don't know, but I would assume.
But this is a residential real estate contract that could apply virtually every real estate sale in the state. Isn't that right?
Correct.
And there's going to be a lot of people.
Correct.
When the seller ties up the $2,000, that could have some real impact on those people.
But when they talk about electing the earnest money, like in Zimmerman, when he held the earnest money, he said, then the plaintiff has the opportunity to avoid the fuss and the hassle of a trial by electing the liquidated damages. You know, the buyer can agree to that to avoid the fuss and bother of a trial. Plaintiff didn't have that option here. He had to sue to get even the earnest money back. He did not have the option to retain the earnest money to avoid the fuss and bother of a trial. He had to start suit to get anything back.
Why couldn't he just request the earnest money?
Because the broker cannot release it without the buyer's consent.
Well, but he never requested it.
Buyer had already indicated that he was demanding the return of the earnest money and would defend vigorously any claim brought by the seller.
Well, if the money had been requested and that request had been denied, now you've got a straight line here. But there was no request.
So when the buyer says, I want it back, and I'm going to defend any claim you make, you're saying the contract requires the futile effort to request it back so that you can say no again. Again, at this point, both sides, neither one has had authorized the other to have it. I mean, that's very clear.
Both parties have taken this case all the way to the Supreme Court, where, I mean, if someone had said, I mean, it seems to me that the default clause of the contract anticipates that the seller will request the money if the seller wants the money. There was no request here, and it seemed to me pretty obvious that's not the path that was being taken. Wanted a lot more.
And again, I'm not sure at what point in time you're talking about. I mean, clearly, before the house was sold, he definitely was not releasing the money. There's no doubt about that. He didn't know if he still had the right to keep the money and sue for specific performance. He didn't know what his damages were going to be. I don't mean to repeat, but the defendant said he wanted the money, he was going to defend vigorously. Again, the quote from Source says, this clause is not designed as an option for the buyer to pay liquidated damages as an alternative to performing the contract. The purpose of the clause is to protect the seller and not to provide an exculpatory method of avoiding the purchase of the real estate. You've got a situation where he's demanded the money. He said he's going to vigorously defend the case. I think it's a safe assumption that if you request the money, you're not going to get it back. And even when the lawsuit was filed, asking for compensatory damages, they were certainly never offered saying, well, geez, take the money and let's call this a day. That offer never came. So again, the complaint asked for compensatory damages. It could be either. Again, if he wanted to offer the earnest money at that time, that offer never came.
How do you respond, counsel, in the brief filed by the realtors on page 11, this passage, they indicate for that reason that they did not initially agree to return the earnest money may have been prudent, reading from page 11. So they assert that initially not returning the earnest money have been prudent.
Where on the page are you?
Very bottom, probably starting about paragraph, line 7. I'm going to focus your attention on this, and then I'll ask you in rebuttal when you have 5 minutes to answer the question. It asserts that initially the seller acted prudently, but once Osborne decided to proceed with litigation for actual damages, the WB-11 requires that they first make a firm decision with regard to the earnest money. I'm going to focus on that when you come back on rebuttal.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dennison? 30 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Harold C. Dennison. I'm the defendant in this case. I was the buyer. I had a speech and everything all prepared here, but after listening to Mr. Becker, I think I'm just going to speak to the fairness of the contract, the fairness of that provision. I think he's right that the seller default provision is in there to protect the seller, but it's also in there to create a fair handling of the earnest money and to create a fair clause in the contract for the buyer, too. The seller had the right The seller had the right to sue for specific performance and keep the earnest money. And the seller also had a right to accept the earnest money as liquidated damages. And lastly, the seller had a right to give that earnest money back and have the right to sue for actual damages. And what the seller did was they tried to sue me for actual damages, even though Mr. Becker calls it compensatory damages. According to the Black's Law Dictionary, compensatory damages is synonymous with actual damages. And compensatory damages is a request for compensation for actual loss. So it has nothing to do with liquidated damages. In the seller's deposition, Mr. Osborne answers yes numerous times when questioned about whether or not was he aware of the timelines during the point at which he filed his suit for actual damages. He answers yes. The question goes on to ask, are you aware of the clause in the contract that states that you're supposed to return or direct your broker to return the earnest money before you have the right to sue for actual damages? He answers yes. Shortly after the failed contract, he stated his position to Attorney Wyatt, his previous attorney, that his intention right from the start was to sue for actual damages. And all along at different intervals, he ordered the broker to maintain control and keep the earnest money from me, even though I had asked for the earnest money early on. And you're right, Your Honor, he never asked for the earnest money as liquidated damages. If he had, believe me, I would let him have it, because the cost of attorneys over the last 4 years has been huge. I think, in all fairness, the seller default clause is written so that, and in this case, I only had $2,000 earnest money up. But sometimes brokers coerce the buyer into putting much larger sums of money up, sometimes $10,000, $20,000, sometimes whatever it is you intend to use as a down payment for your bank loan. They suggest that's a good amount of earnest money to suggest your seriousness or your earnest in buying the house, and it can also help you negotiate a lesser price. So sometimes people put up significantly more money for earnest. And if the seller was allowed to keep that earnest money and bring it an action for actual damages while retaining those valuable assets from the buyer, it would be unfair. It would be totally unfair to the buyer. And a good example would be a young couple, maybe they're buying their first house. They put $20,000 down on a $200,000 offer to purchase. The seller's house has leaky basement walls that they didn't disclose. The young couple fails to close. They're accused of breaching the contract, but in reality, the responsibility for the breach hasn't been determined yet. So it may very well be that the seller was responsible for the breach due to lack of disclosure. So would it be fair to let the seller retain that earnest money for years while they're suing for actual damages, while they sue the couple for actual damages? I don't think so, and that's why the seller default clause is written the way it is. It's fair to both parties. If the seller doesn't want the earnest money's liquidated damages, give it back. Allow the buyer to defend himself, to hire counsel with the money, to hire professionals, professional witnesses, to take depositions. If they didn't want the earnest money's liquidated damages, the contract says direct your broker to return it, and you can have the right to sue for actual damages.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, Mr. Dennison. The Court of Appeals had a case, the Galatowicz case, in 2000. And the way they interpreted this language, they said, look, if the buyer says to the seller indicates they'll keep the money, and the buyer says, keep it, keep it, keep it, then the seller gets the money, and everybody goes home relatively happy. The buyer loses what the earnest money was, offer money was. The seller gets not full damages, but nobody sues, no attorney fees, no delay, etc. What said the Court of Appeals? If the seller doesn't get that earnest money and is forced to sue, then the seller has the option to either, after the lawsuit is started, has the option to either get the earnest money or get full damages. Because, said the Court of Appeals, the easy way out, that is when both parties agree they'll settle it out for $2,000, is gone. And the point of my telling you all of that is to say to you, where did you agree that the seller would get the $2,000 and therefore the seller didn't have to sue? Because that is the goal of the liquidated damages, said the Court of Appeals, because the first option of getting the earnest money doesn't talk about suing at all. It views it as a no-lawsuit case. When there has to be a lawsuit to either get the earnest money or compensatory damages, that the choice is with the seller. So what do you think about that?
I think that once the earnest money was requested, he had a decision to make.
The seller requested the earnest money?
If the seller had requested the earnest money?
Buyer.
I'm asking you.
Buyer requested the earnest money.
Right.
Yes.
Did you ask for the earnest money back?
Yes, ma'am.
You did. Did you ever say to the seller, it's yours?
No.
I've defaulted. No.
The seller always expressed the intent and to sue for actual damages. He never expressed any other intent but to sue for actual damages. So I assumed that he's going to return my earnest money. I asked for it, and he refused. And he directed his broker to withhold the earnest money. So we waited to see when he was going to file for actual damages. Mm-hmm. He sold the house. He filed for compensatory damages, which seems to me to be the same thing as actual damages.
Yeah, I don't think that's debatable.
And then my attorney said, well, they're not allowed to do that. Based on the default clause, the seller default clause, they're required to return those assets to you before they have the option of suing for actual damages. And that's how the whole thing started. And I'm here today to say that's fair. That's very fair. And
couldn't you have gone to small claims court and asked for the liquidate, or not the liquidate, couldn't you have gone to small claims court and asked for the earnest money?
Yes, sir. Yes, I could have, yes.
And
but at that time, I didn't know, maybe he would sell the house and decide that the earnest money would be enough liquidated damages. And so I didn't pursue anything. I just took the wait-and-see approach to see, well, what will the house sell for? And maybe this whole thing will resolve itself. Maybe he'll get more for the house, and I'll get my money back. Maybe he'll get slightly less, and he'll decide to keep the earnest money. He sold the house. I wasn't aware of the sale. But I became aware of the sale when he first filed for actual damages in the amount of, I think it was something like $50,000.
You're a real estate developer?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a real estate license?
No. No, sir. I'm a builder. I'd like to speak about
Mr. Dennison. Before you do that, Mr. Dennison.
Timeline, Mr. Dennison,
before you do that,
I just want to know if this is your position. This is the amicus brief of the Wisconsin Realtors Association. And at the very end of it, and I'm sure you've read this,
yes,
they say that this court must affirm the trial court decision limiting Osborne's damages to the $2,000 earnest money plus costs because Osborne failed to direct the broker to return the earnest money to Dennison before suing for actual damages. Is that the heart of your argument? Is that
yes,
what you
sir.
Want us to do?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank
it's,
you.
That's fair. That's fair. Because if they're not going to accept the earnest money as liquidated damages, those are assets that can be used by the buyer to defend his position. If you leave the decision of when to return the earnest money up to the seller, I can tell you right now, they won't return it unless they absolutely have to. They'll use it and apply it to whatever actual damages they get. And a demonstration of that is here in June 23rd, 2006, sellers for the first time direct their broker to return earnest money. June 2006. This is a letter that my attorney sent to Mr. Becker 2 years later, asking for the return of the earnest money. 2 years after they claimed they directed the broker to return the earnest money. 2 years later, their broker still had the earnest money. This was 6 months after they made a demand for the earnest money liquidated damages. After their award, they went to the Kenosha County Clerk of Court's office and filed a judgment against me on my credit for liquidated damages. And I didn't discover that until I tried to get a loan for my business, and the bank said, well, you have a judgment. And then I found out, well, they'd filed a judgment demanding the liquidated damages they'd been awarded. Then I went and paid Mr. Becker at his office in October of 2007. I had to pay him, even though their broker had the earnest money, I had to come into his office with another $2,000 and pay him the liquidated damages while their broker actually had the money. So if you leave it up to the seller as to when they'll return the earnest money, that'll never happen. And I think this is a very fair clause for the buyer, because at no time, once the real estate transaction fails and it goes into litigation, the buyer and the seller, neither one is held to be responsible yet. A court's going to determine that. So why should the buyer be put at a financial disadvantage in allowing the seller to retain earnest money while he's suing for actual damages, when it may very well be the seller who's responsible for the breach?
Well, the problem, at least as I understand it, seems to be that until the two of you agree as to the release of that earnest money, the broker isn't going to do anything with it, because the broker doesn't want a lawsuit by either one of you. The broker wants the commission. That's what the broker wants, right? So that's why the money is sitting there. That's why neither one of you has access to the money. Neither one of you has interest from the money. Just sitting there waiting for a decision.
Once the buyer asks for the return of the earnest money, if the seller refuses, he now has all the control. So if the seller is in control of the earnest money from that point on, it's his decision what happens to the earnest money, not the broker's. He can request it and request to the buyer that it be released for liquidated damages, which he didn't do, or he can direct that broker to return the earnest money. I'm going to sue for actual damages. He has the control. The seller has the control. And he exercised his control and retained that earnest money and sued me for actual damages at the same time. And that wasn't fair.
Exactly when did you ask for the return of the earnest money?
Seven days after the contract didn't close, on May 25th, 2005.
But then you didn't ask for it again.
No.
Got it.
So they've been paid their liquidated damages. They demanded it after they were awarded it. They've been paid their liquidated damages. Now here we are today, they're asking the court permission to sue me also for actual damages. You can see how a seller can abuse the use of the earnest money. And I think this seller default clause is very fair in the way it's written, and it's been interpreted with Galowitz versus Why Not and Zimmerman versus Thompson. The court has ruled that the earnest money needs to be directed to be returned to the buyer in order to have a right to sue for actual damages. If you're not going to accept it as liquidated damages, the court's ruled you need to return it before you have the right to sue for actual damages.
Thank you. Do you want to comment any further to the court?
I said everything.
Do you happen to know Where does this form come from, the residential real estate form?
I believe the Realtors Association is responsible for drafting it.
Do you know that for a fact? Or?
No, sir, I don't. I tried to find out more information about the mindset behind that clause. I tried to look into Wisconsin Real Estate Brokers Manual, and I read as much as I could about it, but I couldn't really find anywhere where it laid out the drafting of the attorney's mindset when they drafted that particular clause. So I'm not sure how they arrived at it, but to be honest with you, it seems fair. It may not seem fair to the seller here in this case that it's only $2,000 and he sold the house for less money, but it's not just about this case. It's about every case that hinges on this offer to purchase form. And like I said many times, you're going to have buyers who are coerced into putting up much larger amounts of earnest money. And in that case, it could, fortunately for me, it wasn't that much. I had other funds I could defend myself with, which I've exhausted quite a bit of. But it could be a financial burden that could cause an unfair advantage easily by sellers who just refuse to return their earnest money, even though they're not interested in liquidated damages.
Are there any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dennison. We appreciate your coming. Mr. Becker?
Justice Bradley, just to get back to your question, again, what the brokers have argued here is basically the same thing that was in the initial brief, is that they're arguing that he must first make the decision, and the contract doesn't say that. They have also inserted the word first into the contract.
Yes. And that's exactly what I wanted to focus on. And you discussed the purpose of this provision and the purpose of the liquidated damages to protect the seller, and that seems to be quite true. But another purpose that's stated in the Zimmerman case and the Galatowicz case is that liquidated damages is to allow a seller a remedy without further fuss or bother, they say. And by that, I take it to mean without further fuss or bother of lawsuits. And then the Zimmerman case goes on to say, and the language was cited with approval in the Galatowicz case and in this case, it goes on to say, so, you can't have it both ways, seller. You can't both, and I quote, retain the earnest money as liquidated damages without the fuss or bother of a lawsuit and bring a suit for additional damages at the same time. So doesn't that speak to what has to be done first?
No, because he did not have the right to that money to avoid the fuss and bother of a lawsuit. They had requested the money back. They had not authorized a return. Alcorn was not retaining the money. Mr. Dennison said, well, he can use it to finance his lawsuit. He couldn't. The broker was holding it. This clause is to protect the broker, to get the broker out of it. That's what the clause is probably for. Mr. Dennison talked about many things that weren't really in the record about when he got the money and stuff, but he had the right to go in June of 06 and get the money from the broker. He just chose not to do so.
Let's look at the language of the, because that's what this case is focused on, the language in the contract. And it says in relevant part, I'll forget the specific performance.
You're at page what of the red brief, the appendix?
33.
Okay. Justice Bradley is reading from the form, and it's in Mr. Dennison's brief, appendix 33.
It's 33. I don't care about this.
Is that right?
Page 4 or 5 of the residential offer to purchase. It's the fourth page.
Okay.
Okay. And on line 233, it states that you have the option to A, request the earnest money as liquidated damages. That's one option, right?
Correct.
When did you do that?
You never did that.
Okay, so then, since you didn't request the earnest money as liquidated damages, you can, or direct the broker to return the earnest money, and have the option to sue for actual damages. And that's what the fight, your fight is here.
Right.
The absence of the language before or first or some kind of sequence other than the sequence of the sentence itself.
Correct. Because, again, if a person cannot get the earnest money back and avoid the fuss and bother of a trial, then they have to start suit. So the question is, okay, at that point they may not even know. So, again, at some point, that is a date that should be set by the scheduling lawyer. You know, by this date, you have to, you know, provide the defendant with the damages you are claiming and what proof you are relying on.
I read Galowich.
I'm sorry.
I read Galowich as in your favor. Do you read Galowich in your favor?
Sorry.
I read the Galowich case in your favor. Do you read it?
Yes.
As in your favor?
I think if you rule for the defendant here, you have to overrule Galowich.
Pardon me?
I believe if you rule for the defendant here, you have to overrule Galowich.
You don't cite Galowich.
I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed it. You do. At 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, etc. Yes. Sorry. And in your reply.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're relying on that.
Yes.
Which said no election of remedies, and you didn't have to put back the earnest money before you started a lawsuit. In Galowich, the court held you did not have to return the money before starting the suit. Is the provision in Galowich the same as in this case?
Yes, it is.
And it was different in, was it Zimmerman? Pardon me?
It was a different clause in Zimmerman.
And Galowich case distinguished Zimmerman for that reason. Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Becker, and thank you, Mr. Dennison, for appearing today. We especially appreciate Mr. Dennison that you came and not being a lawyer and having to go in a court of law. So thank you. Thank you. And that concludes our hearing on 07-AP-1799 Douglas Osborne versus Harold Dennison. Court will take a brief recess so that the students may leave if they wish and other students may come in. We are in recess.